It's sunny in October in the United Kingdom, which is mind-blowing to me. I'm guessing you're sort of somewhere in the middle. It's kind of overcast, something like that in the Bay. What was it like?
We had an awesome heat wave about a week ago. Went away, but I was on the beach actually two nights ago with the kids and saw the Comet flying over the Golden Gate Bridge, which is pretty awesome.
Nice. That's rare and awesome.
I hadn't paid attention to what was going on, and I was like, what is that? It's so cool.
Well, you don't expect that every day. That's nice. Oh, look, a comment. Oh, wait, that's extremely rare. I like things that you don't expect. That's my favorite. Yeah. Counterintuitive.
Yeah. Well, more exciting than the weather, let's talk about fintech. I don't know if it is more exciting, but maybe for our audience, it's more exciting.
I think heck yeah, right? Like, people who know me know for a long time I've been an advocate of, like, fintech is not dead. And rumors of its demise have been overstated.
I posted a chart from F Prime's FinTech Index, and it shows FinTech up and to the right way more so than anything else, down and to the right way faster. But post the recovery has also been stronger, and so my little takeaway was, don't tell anyone. Good things are happening.
Look, we'll look back on it as the FinTech bubble, and it... A lot of us knew it was sort of a bubble at the time. It was kind of obvious. But a bubble doesn't mean that there's not something valuable there, and it creates massive opportunities. So long may we continue creating those opportunities. What are you seeing as the biggest ops?
I think what I saw is, first, the public markets weren't very smart on fintech. And they're like, all revenue is good. And in financial services, you can drive low-quality revenue like nobody's business. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh my God, this is terrible. It's low quality revenue. Throw everything out. Yeah. And now what we're seeing is that the markets, the investors, the founders, everyone is learning what it takes to build good companies with good fundamentals. Mm-hmm. And look, they're not wrong. Like, if you looked at some companies, I think, I don't want to knock on InsurTech too much, because InsurTech today that I'm seeing is very different from InsurTech that's in the public markets. But there are a lot of consumer InsurTech companies with negative loss ratios that raise hundreds of millions of dollars and are trading a little bit above the total dollar value raised. And so they had negative loss ratios, basically means they would give you money and then people would ask for more in claims than they paid in premiums. So that's like the movie pass economy. So, like, it's not that investors were wrong at one point in time. It's that they overcorrected into all categories. And now what we're starting to see is that coming out. And even some of those insurtechs now have, you know, wait for it, non-negative loss ratios. And then other categories are doing much better. So
it's crazy. There's the classic example of better.com as well, which at one point had, you know, you probably do a better job of explaining better.com than I would, but this was where you go to get new mortgage offers and new mortgage deals, and they were underwriting massive amounts of mortgages. And they were essentially, in a low interest rate environment, they were crushing it. They were delivering incredible EBITDA. This looked like one of the all-time great companies, and yet it was probably not a sustainable model throughout the credit cycle, because if interest rates did go up and the market froze, then all the money stopped coming in and they'd have all of their costs still. So yeah, that there are some lessons that have been learned. We speed ran how to learn what a credit cycle looks like, but it's turning. So what are the categories that are that you're seeing that are kind of leading from the front here as we get closer to public markets?
Before we even talk about categories, I just want to talk about the market overall. So you mentioned this, which is basically startups have about, you know, 3% market share, and then some of the stats around what it looks like to go into the whole broader market. And then we can drill down some of the stats there in that report.
Yeah, sure. So the stats I had were saying that sort of in those categories, you would see that fintech revenue growth overall has remained solid at 14% compound annual. But if you exclude China and crypto, that's 21%. And while funding's plummeted, revenue multiples have stabilized and normalized, and that growth is kind of consistently strong. But there's real differences in sectors and geographies. So anybody who's a challenger bank, neobank, has actually done really well, which if you go back to 2022, neobanks were dead. Anything that was Durbin debit was obviously just kind of like arbitrage of regulation. It was going to go away. How were they ever going to be profitable? Well, around the world, there are multiple examples that are. And indeed, even Chime is on its path to profitability, despite ultra-thin margins. Yep. And then lending and payments are leading from the front. And yes, there are losers in lending, as we've talked about. But those in BNPL and B2B BNPL, that whole space have done extremely well. And the space of like payments just generally continues to massively, massively grow as the Stripes and Adyens of the world drag everything up kind of around it. So that's kind of the winners and losers as certainly as that report saw it.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, there are lots of categories in which you have lots of like meat on the bone for startups to come to the table and get a piece of. And we just talked about how public markets are starting to do a lot better. I can give a vantage point on like the very early stage side of fintech, which I think is doing quite well from a funding perspective. Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit of a messy middle. So first let's talk about like the early stage. So like, yes, funding in absolute dollars are down. But what I think a lot of people miss then is that's because we're not doing these mega rounds for pre-IPO companies that actually obscure the extent to which they are good companies. Like if you are a Chime or someone else who has low margins, an investor shows up and says, hey, I've got $300 million invested in growth. It just makes it harder to tell like the quality of the revenue, right? Because there's just this availability of cheap capital. But that's kind of gone and slowed down. But if we do, and that blew up the funding numbers. So when you hear fintech funding is down 60, 70%, you're like, oh man, nothing's getting funded. The reality is the same number of companies are getting funded as basically 2019, 2020. It's just that the rounds are smaller. And so if you look at pre-seed and seed, and now increasingly even Series A, we actually are seeing the same number of companies created. I think if you're a founder or someone building or thinking about building, the key takeaway there is, you know, it's never easy to raise, but if you want to raise and you have a good idea, capital is as available as it's ever been. So that's really important at like the pre-seed and seed. Series A has just started ticking back up. And actually, if you look at the Series A valuations, they're very close to all-time highs on a post-money basis. The one thing that's a little bit different is that the time between rounds from seed to Series A has gone from, you know, it used to be like 6 months during the boom to like 2 years, which is more normal. So all that is to say, if you are building something, that thing is interesting, you have, you know, some traction, or at the pre-seed and seed, a very good idea and vision, you will be able to raise money. There's still a little bit of a messy middle where you start getting north of Series B pre-IPO or even IPO. Like, we don't have a robust IPO pipeline with clear visibility as to the timing, where it's like, okay, what is happening? And I think actually this is the public markets, I think, are farther along than the late stage private markets at digesting and understanding what is and isn't working, because things have started to grow there.
Well, it's pretty obvious to me that Klarna and, to a lesser extent, Chime, but certainly Plaid are on their IPO tour. And whether it's 25 or 26, you know, Klarna feels like every other press release is, look how cost efficient we're getting, look how much AI we're using, look at our path to profitability/profitability in core markets. These are messages being done on purpose, and they're sort of hinting at, we're going to IPO, we're thinking about it. And there's no smoke without fire. They're definitely testing the waters and trying to price that, and they're doing so very visibly and very publicly. But this is, of course, the canonical, they were once valued at $40 billion, then dropped to $6 billion in a secondary. Now they're pricing an IPO at 20. Like, that's pretty, suddenly makes that $6 billion round that was mostly an insider round where a lot of folks doubled down on them, makes that look like good business all of a sudden. That suddenly looks a lot better. So you gotta imagine good business is being done all over the market. There are some companies that maybe are in a slightly different position, that took massive, massive rounds in 2021 and now have to figure out how on earth they grow into that, especially if their growth rate's not there. But, you know, there are companies with hundreds of millions, if not billions of revenue, come ready to go to the market that are testing that. So what's going to break the dam on that, and what's your analysis?
Yeah, first of all, it's okay if companies don't grow in the public markets, because if you look at the public markets like the S&P 500, Google, Facebook, Amazon have delivered like the majority of the returns in the last 10 years. It's some huge percentage of it. So even in the public markets, it's still kind of a power law game. And so even if you pick out some folks in the public markets who haven't done particularly well, that doesn't mean like the whole category is out. And I think actually there's much more broad-based success stories to share within fintech. So that's one thing. And then other success stories, I mean, what's hard is a lot of the success stories I'm hearing about are late-stage privates with companies still growing, producing profitability, but not raising rounds. And so there's nothing I can really talk about publicly. But there are some big companies that I think are in where you look at their growth rates, their move to profitability, and especially you compare their growth rates to what's going on in the public markets. And the public market, like very few things are, especially within fintech, but even within B2B SaaS more broadly, are growing north of 20% year over year. And there are some really great companies growing well north of that in the private markets, which I think will create appetite. And then we're going into a rate tightening cycle, which on the margin is a tailwind. But I think it's more about the business funnel.
What I like fundamental about economics. Klarna and take a company like Revolut, is these private companies have their accounts published. So Revolut had nearly doubled revenues last year to $2.2 billion. They added 12 million new customers and delivered $545 million in profit.
Yeah.
Now, you know, a lot of that's driven by rates, and there's a big piece of that. But adding 12 million customers in European markets, which is where the vast majority...
Yeah.
This is not... You could argue that some of the developing economies and some of the outside of the top 20, you can win there if you execute well. Harder to do in stodgy European markets, although granted we do have some growth markets. If you look further to the east of Europe, if you look at Romania, Bulgaria, etc., Poland, where a lot of Revolut's growth comes from, those are the growth markets of Europe. Still, there's real numbers. They're putting up the numbers, and it's impressive to watch.
I think there are a lot of categories where we've gone through the trough of disillusionment. Now we're on the slope of enlightenment, but we have just mental fatigue of hearing the stories of like, oh, Revolut added X million, you know, in customers. Yeah. We've been hearing that story for so many years. It just kind of loses its, its zing. But then you back up, you're like, oh my God, like that's still quite remarkable.
Yeah, it's a clickbaity headline, but on the just like the sheer number, it's kind of like a Steph Curry does big numbers, LeBron does big numbers, and you're like, yeah, tell me something new, you know? It's still great performance.
Yeah, yeah. And what I like seeing too is like the product ambitions of these companies, even at scale, continues in terms of, you know, launching new products. Getting back into lending in more material ways. Like I think for Chime, that's going to be one of the big things they do want to prove out before going public.
Yeah, and you look at the Moneylions of the world, they've done really interesting things with their marketplace, and they're playing in kind of a different space. The SoFis of the world have been in the public market for a while. They sell just about every product known to goodness. There's a really interesting company I came across the other day called Gigs that does white label mobile virtual network operator. They do it for both Revolut and for Nubank. So this is like they're selling eSIMs now. So that whole like product expansion is kind of not just customer expansion is working for them. And then the last thing in this report that's probably worth mentioning is that embedded finance will be worth more than $320 billion in revenues by 2030, which to my mind makes it the biggest revenue growth opportunity in all of financial services. Like if you look across all of the categories, banking as a service, embedded finance just has such a dirty word, especially in the United States, but it's kind of true in Europe as well. Nobody likes it. It's associated with risk. And yet it's where all the growth's coming from. So maybe it's a good idea. It's just not necessarily going to be, the winners aren't going to be the same people.
Yeah. And I think let's tell a story about a specific company in embedded finance. So I just interviewed Tomer, the co-founder of Gusto, and they announced embedded a little over a year ago. It was 3 years ago, 2021, they announced it. Last year, they announced a partnership with JP Morgan where they're going to be the embedded payroll provider for JP Morgan's 6 million SMB customers. So if you look at payroll, Gusto has 300,000 direct customers. That's less than 6% market share. They've now done a partnership with the biggest bank in the US that has huge reach. And so you're saying, oh my God, there's so much potential for just an embedded payroll product to start getting distributed in new ways. And if you look at market cap for publicly traded payroll companies, it's like it's over $80 billion, and some of them, you know, are many tens of millions. And they haven't felt any pressure from the new payroll providers of the world like Gusto, even though they have 300,000 mostly small customers. And so we're just starting to scratch the surface on some of these things for these scale players, just as we start to kind of get tired of hearing some of these stories. And so that's exciting. And that story is true for embedded in other areas outside of payroll.
Completely. You see it a lot in the payment space. We just saw, I think just yesterday, the news broke of Navan partnering with Brex. So this is, I just did not have that on my bingo card because I thought, you know, 2 years ago, all of the spend management cards like Brex and Ramp and everybody else were launching their own travel portals. What's happening now is a little bit different. They're sort of buddying up. Navan just went this other way. They went to kind of, let's bring your own card. And that positions them really interestingly. Navan also partnered with Citi's commercial card business. So they're going after that like Amex Travel, Conquer, SAP sort of space that's been really big and really legacy. And they could really run at it. So that like everybody's your frenemy, that 2 years ago, everybody had enough budget and could raise another round to just go build it and go compete with the sun and the universe and everyone in it. Now the mentality's changed a little bit. It's like, if you win, we win. And what are the partnership opportunities has become a bigger default.
Yeah. And financial services, I feel like, is always in this place where you're frenemies, right? Because products naturally overlap and intersect with other financial flows. And we're figuring out what those partnerships, what makes the most sense. And that'll keep evolving too. So I think let's wrap it up. Like, what do you think are the big takeaways here for folks listening, especially people building in fintech? One is, I think, you know, people listening are probably generally bought in if they're taking time to listen to
watching a show about fintech from two fintech
As opposed to like about AI. So I don't know if we need to convince you that like there are interesting things here, but maybe you now have some more like data and talking points when you talk to your friends about like why what you're building is interesting.
I think the big takeaway is you gotta ignore the noise. You mentioned the headlines about like they do another big thing and it gets boring, there's job losses and it seems horrible. Like that roller coaster will constantly be happening, but there are material profit pools. Financial services remains the world's largest profit pool. If you're building something and you have traction, you are building in the most interesting and possibly massive opportunity space. And we've barely even scratched the surface of one of the things that I had in mind to talk about, which was the whole private credit space. Just as a bonus one to finish off, Klarna's announced they're selling $39 billion of loans to a private credit fund, which means there's a whole bunch, like if you were going to go build a lending startup tomorrow, there's a whole bunch of new investors who want to help you be able to set up that lending business so that you don't end up in the position that some of the folks in the last credit cycle might have done, where they didn't necessarily have supply, even though they had demand. So the space is changing, and I'm excited. It feels like
you can't drop stuff like that at the end where it's like private credit. That's like a three. We could talk about that for 4 or 5 episodes. But you're right. Yeah, there are all these changes that are afoot that are super interesting.
I don't know what happened to my Wi-Fi there, or your Wi-Fi, or something in between. But yeah, I'm just throwing that out there as a little nugget. Go check out what's happening with private credit.
Well, maybe that'll be something we talk about next week because we got some threads. But if there are other topics people want to listen to have us cover, they should definitely let us know in the comments, and we'd be happy to. Also, you know, we learn from people like you listening to this, especially this early in the podcast. Probably most of the listeners here are much deeper on individual topics than we are.
Yes.
And we learn from folks like you. So if you have, you know, comments, things you think we said that are wrong, or, you know, gloss over some of the complexity, we'd love to go to the next level, and we can maybe address some of those comments in future videos too.
Would love to go deeper. Thanks for having me once again.
All right. Good to see you. Take care.
Be well, sir.